Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we're glad to be back. It's been a few days.
Yeah. By the way, I'm also sick, so like that's fun for everybody. Yeah. But I think that we kind of let Holy Week get the best of us in that we didn't schedule any interviews for this week.
Well, we did have a few, but then there were a bunch cancellations. Of
people canceled on us, and yeah. But we're here now, and we're really excited to have one of my coworkers and new friends. We have Nat Rosa Madrid here with us today. Hey, Nat.
Hi, y'all.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing all right. I'm just tired. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just like because we haven't been doing the like soul satisfying work of the podcast.
Yeah.
And I've just been like. Sitting. Laying on the couch eating bonbons. So not really. I wish.
Be yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Crackling. I've only had, like, vegan bonbons. So we're both vegan. I've only had vegan bonbons, like, once, I think, because they're kind of weird to make.
Yeah.
That tofutti cream cheese, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you do a lot of different things in town, and we're excited to have you on to talk about them.
So you're a designer. Can you tell us a little more about your designs?
Sure. I'm an artist and a designer here in Chicago, and I have a collection of femme-centric fetish and bondage gear called Nat.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
No, and I love that, because we were talking about it before the show, and you were kind of mentioning like that's like your brand's name, and so it's your name, but it's also your brand's name, which is really cool.
Yeah, you know, a while ago when I was leaving school, I just titled my creations that I was making Nat, all capital letters, and was doing that for a while, and I had the same Facebook and the same Instagram, and I realized that I was living my digital life as if I were a brand, but I'm not always a brand. So I actually had to create two separate Instagrams, one for myself and one for my brand, and then one Facebook for myself and one for my brand, because I didn't want to live my life out as a brand.
Yeah.
That's just a title of what I sell.
That's super interesting, and that's actually something that musicians kind of fall into the trap of like, you know, there's... I have a friend, for instance, who's a tenor, and his name is Peter Drackley, but his performer name is Peter Scott Drackley. And so he has two Facebooks. He has Peter Scott Drackley Tenor, and he has just Peter Drackley, where he posts selfies of him eating ice cream and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because, like, you know, sometimes you gotta, like, you know, unlace and, like...
Yeah. No, and I was trying to think of, like... It's interesting to me, too, because I was trying to think of a good example of just, like, some celebrity that was like, I'm going to put out a line with Target, and then it's just going to be my first name. And I think that's, like, such a more... Maybe legitimate is the wrong word, but, like, such a more interesting angle to go with that, you know? And so it's G-N-A-T. Is that your born name?
No. Actually, my name is Natalie. And that's, like, a name that people who are close to me call me. It's more intimate. But whenever I was in college and I was exploring my gender identity a little more, Natalie felt so gendered in a way that felt uncomfortable that I started going by Nat.
Yeah.
I shortened it and changed the spelling because I was in art school and I was just trying to experiment with my gender and my identity. And Nat totally stuck.
Yeah.
So I go by both names, but I prefer Nat.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and like, so, like I was saying, Nat and I are coworkers, and like on the schedule, it says Nat, spelled G-N-A-T.
Yeah.
She made it like super clear in orientation. Yeah. Like, my name is Nat. My name is not Natalie.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck yeah, dude.
My mom calls me Natalie, you know?
Yeah.
Natalia, but like at work, I don't want people calling me that. It's too intimate.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way about when I always introduce myself as Maureen, like once people get to know me, they start calling me Mo. Like my mom calls me Mo. Daniel will occasionally call me Mo. Like, you know, close friends and family, but I never introduce myself as that. Just because it feels like it feels intimate to be like, my name is Mo, as opposed to like, if I don't know.
That's why I tend to use the more formal Mosefina Maya Maya. Personally, that's just my
just
own.
Just because our relationship is very business centric. Right.
Well, so I'm interested in, I just cut you off.
No, we may have been asking the same question. I'm interested in how you got started designing femme-centric fetish wear.
Sure. So I did my undergrad BFA at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Cool.
And that was really amazing. I was in their very intense and competitive fashion program. But I also dabbled in a lot of different subjects. I did classes in fiber and material studies, print media, painting, queer theory, gender and women's studies. So I was just living my interdisciplinary life there. It was great. And, you know, 4 years later in 2013, I hadn't slept for many years, but I graduated and won the WOC Fellowship, which is a fellowship that they give to a graduating senior to kind of start their career as a fashion designer. And at that time, I'd also won the Critical Fierceness Grant from Chances Dances, which is a queer empowering artist grant that is funded by dance parties here in Chicago. So I was very honored to receive these grants. And with that money, I used it to kind of invest in my home studio because I'd been using the school's resources for a while. And while I was in school, I was studying all of the normal stuff of fashion design school, like women's wear, men's wear, accessories. And because I am a queer identified person, that felt kind of limiting to talk about apparel and clothing in this very binary and normative way. And while I am very skilled at creating actual garments, like blouses and suits and dresses and gowns or whatever, I started making accessories and fetish gear while I was in school. So I was wearing these pieces out and about. And I was very influenced early on by Xanabane, who is a designer in like the fashion world, who creates leather harnesses and other kinds of like fashion fetish pieces. And I saw her doing that. And she's also like a curvy, badass femme with big curly hair. And I was like, oh, wait, I'm a curvy femme with curly hair, you know, like being myself. And so I started making my own harnesses because I couldn't afford hers. But I was using this glittery vinyl and colorful leathers instead. So I started making these really colorful, super queer harnesses and garments and stuff. You know, I just make clothes to go out in. And after school, you know, after working late night in the studio, I would just kind of do my makeup in the bathroom and go out to a dance party wearing work and being cute and feeling myself. So that's kind of how the brand started.
Yeah.
And did you gain attention from wearing your stuff out and people asking you, like, what, you know, where you got it?
Definitely. Folks would be like, this is amazing, where did you get this? And I'll say, I made it, you know? And I was in school, and they would be like, can you make me one? And I was like, no, I don't know. You know, I was busy.
Yeah.
But my friends pestered me so much that I started an Etsy shop.
Nice.
And so I don't know how I managed to start an Etsy shop during school because I was so busy. But in between my school projects, I would make these other projects and just ship them out.
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you, now that you have been making the fetish wear for a while, I'm like weirdly, I just felt myself getting weird. I call it the gear. Sure, sure.
Yeah, we're saying that gear.
Do you find it's more intent? Like, do people end up wearing it more in private or more out?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that a lot of folks buy it for showing up at a place and looking really cute. I make a lot of pieces for like music videos, for like drag performers, for folks performing in any sense. But a lot of folks also buy my work to use in private. Because I went to school and learned so much about materials and garments. My pieces are created for fashion, but also for use. So they're very heavy duty. They're made to be used as accessories to BDSM.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool. What was the first piece of gear you designed?
I actually have a picture of it, like a 35 millimeter picture on my fridge. But whenever I was in college, I was the leader of the queer social group on mm-hmm. campus. And we did an art show in this person's attic that we used as a gallery space. And we called the show Out of the Closet and Into the Attic, which I think is really cute. But yeah, I'd been playing with the concept of glittery bondage and thinking a lot about my own sexuality and my kinkiness and my identity. So I made this blue glittery harness, a pair of cuffs, a blindfold, and maybe like a choker. And I just put them on the wall as kind of a sculptural piece, just kind of thinking about queer sexuality, BDSM, and kinkiness in more of a femme context. I think that my work is usually, or work like mine rather, is made in black leather for leather daddies, for men, for masculine identified gay people, but that doesn't always reflect everyone in the LGBTQ spectrum.
Mm. Yeah, I was gonna say, I was just going to ask if there was a more masculine connotation to the BDSM movement. Have you noticed a trend toward femme within that group? Or are you one of the first people to move toward a more femme-identifying BDSM movement?
Totally. You know, the history of leather is very masculine, and I am grateful to like the gay elders that came before me that created that space. But I think that now that we are contemporary queer people, we need to move beyond that binary. The scene is very masculine. It's very male-centric. Every year there's IML, which is International Mr. Leather. It's a huge leather pageant that descends on Chicago, which is iconic and amazing, but it is mostly men. There are some women and some femmes in the mix, but they're not greatly represented at all and not always welcome.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. You know, there's a party here in Chicago called Men's Room, and historically it's been men only, and now the curators are more accepting and celebrating of femmes and women coming. But to create more space like that, they invited me on to help host a party called Femmes Room. Mm. And it's the femme version of that, because they realized that their party was centering way too much around masculinity and not enough around femininity.
Mm. Yeah, no, and that just makes sense. It's just broadening inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear a little bit more about the School of the Art Institute, because so I went to Roosevelt University. I did my master's there. And so my what's the word I'm looking for? Conception, maybe, or like understanding of the School of the Art Institute is very limited, in that I remember walking from one building to the other, and in between, so like in between Jackson and I don't know, maybe Monroe or something like that, there's that there's the School of the Art Institute building.
Mm-hmm.
That's on Michigan. And I would always catch like just people coming out for their break from classes. And it was always just like a bunch of really hip looking people like rolling their own cigarettes. And so like, I just have a very specific image of like what people from, the School of Institute are like. But yeah, I mean, it's really cool to actually hear about, are there a lot of people that do kind of like interdisciplinary studies? Like, for those at home, she nodded yes. Are there a lot of, like, what would you say are the most common majors there, or kind of what people may you like not easily recognized, because that's not the fairest way to put it, but do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, definitely.
That, yeah.
The School of the Art Institute is different than a lot of other like artistic trade schools in that it focuses solely on concept and art and not on business, capitalism, or skills to get you through real life.
Right.
So I love the School of the Art Institute, but because that school is so expensive, and it's one of the most expensive art schools in the country and one of the most prestigious, class was a huge indicator of what people were going to do in their life or were doing. So a lot of wealthy kids went to this school experimenting with art, and it created an interesting environment. Like I said, I was in the fashion design program, and that is one of the programs that you have to apply for, submit a portfolio, and get accepted. There are only a few programs like that in the school, but the rest is interdisciplinary. So a lot of folks went to SAIC, took many classes, learned many things, but didn't come out with like a clear path towards a career, which I think is very amazing in the sense that they created artists who make amazing work and don't focus too much on capitalism or like trades in the arts. But I think that the School of the Art Institute didn't prepare a lot of us for making money as artists, which is a real struggle. A lot of folks there study in like the painting and drawing department, in print media, so creating beautiful art. There wasn't a huge push towards graphic design or kind of those like industrialized skills at SAIC, but I do know some amazing type designers who went there, website designers, but most folks do kind of purist studies in making amazing art.
That's really interesting though that you mentioned a bit about just kind of the financial class situation of it, because I think it's interesting when you get into educational areas where that is a factor. Sometimes I feel like I've read many a tale, better trying to understand neoliberalism. I've read many a discussion about it, about talking about it, where it's this very consumerist heavy concept, and a really easily lendable metaphor to it is like the student in class who is like, well, I'm paying this teacher's salary, so I am I'm paying for my grades, or like I'm paying for how well I do. But that's did you feel like there was a good deal of that, or do you feel like it was more because they are kind of leaning more on concept rather than results?
Totally. That's a good question. I think sometimes, yes, I would see that type of attitude. But also, as someone who didn't come from a wealthy family and my family wasn't funding my education, I did expect a lot out of my professors. And sometimes when they wouldn't deliver, that was super frustrating. Because my program was so intense, and it's notoriously very intense, I felt very satisfied by my program,
right?
Because it really pushed me to learn a lot in a short amount of time and make amazing art. And the connections that I made there are invaluable. I studied with Anka Lowe, who's this amazing designer and artist from Antwerp, and through some connections and some friends and a lot of great recommendations, she helped me get an internship in Paris with Bernard Wilhelm, who's one of my favorite designers. So the artists and professors that teach at SAIC are very prestigious and very well connected because they're so amazing.
Yeah.
So I think that I used all of that to my advantage as someone coming into it with all of my own money.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's a really important thing. And I think a lot of times with art schools in general, like the, so I went to Roosevelt, but I specifically went to the Chicago College of Performing Arts. And it's a similar thing in that you go and you get your master's degree. And I mean, there was some result driven stuff. I mean, like a lot of, there were a couple specific classes that were like, what to do after you graduate, like what young artist programs you should apply for and stuff like that. But then there is also kind of that freedom of like what electives you choose and stuff like that, and trying to figure out kind of like the room to define yourself as an artist, and to the room to say like, these are the things that I want to have an understanding and a focus on. And I think that's really important and really interesting in that kind of conversation of being able to say like, well, I'm going to dip a little bit into this and a dip mm-hmm. a little bit into this. So my next kind of question is, the first thing I think of when I think of the Art Institute is just the rich history of the Art Institute. I had a membership, and so I'd just walk around in my breaks because that place is so great. But what we talk about a lot with different people of different fields and stuff is next steps after a degree. And I think you provide a really interesting perspective into that, because what you're doing now, well, so here's my question. What is the prescribed steps for a classical singer would be like going to a young artist program, doing auditions, yeah. and just kind of like doing the, you know.
Yeah, and a young artist program is something where an opera company will open up their resources to young artists and kind of hire them on for a summer or a season, and provide coachings and, you know, performance opportunities on a smaller scale, and just kind of provide an educational resource. And when I say hire on, I mean you usually have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like an internship?
Kind of.
It basically straddles that. So
it's kind of like an adult summer camp.
Oh. Yeah, and you have pay to sings. You have young artist programs that are pay to sings where you pay for them, and then it's like you're paying for it. And then there's also paid young artists, and that is like a paid internship. Okay. So that, drawing that comparison, my question here is, what would you say people that come out of art schools and like extremely intensive art schools like SAIC and other schools, what is the kind of the expected, for the lack of a better word, like expected track, and how did that, in either like following it or shunning it, how did that affect what you're doing now?
Totally. You know, like I was saying before, at SAIC, it was so not focused on the workforce that mm-hmm. they didn't even necessarily tell us what to do afterwards. I imagine there maybe were classes surrounding that, but it was not required. And the guidance counseling there didn't really empower us to do any of those things. So you would see a lot of grads who made amazing work and worked so hard graduate and then kind of tread water, like not really knowing what to do next. In my program, the advice that we got was from our professors in anecdotes, because these professors had started small clothing lines or right. worked for artists or done lots of things. So they would just give us advice or give us stories. That was probably the strongest like mentorship that I got from that. Doing internships was not required in our department. Although most fashion schools, it is required that you do a fashion internship over the summer or over 2 summers. I was one of a few students in my whole class who actually did one, which I mentioned earlier, and it was amazing. It was so special. I was working for this amazing designer in Paris, like in his studio, working with him closely to develop garments and accessories for his new season, which is very lucky. A lot of folks who work in fashion go to New York for a summer and get cupcakes and coffee for Marc Jacobs, you know, because the industry is so competitive and so huge. It's really hard for young designers and students to kind of get awesome internships or jobs right out of school.
That was going to be my next question. The kind of like the nitty gritty of what goes into a fashion internship, because for musicians, it's a lot of just, you're assigned a role.
Learn it before you get there.
Yeah, learn your music before you get there. You're in rehearsals all day. You'll have a coaching or a lesson, and then you perform at night. And that's kind of, you know, you're there by 10 a.m., you leave at midnight, and you do that 6 days a week for a summer. And so I'm just kind of wondering, so for you, you kind of had the dream internship, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, like, what was a day in the life of a fashion internship in Paris?
Sure. Well, I rented an Airbnb, and I would ride my bike there. It was just on a little street. The studio was a converted apartment that had big tables, messy boxes full of stuff. Bernard was there, kind of like smelly and shirtless and sexy. He's amazing. He's just like a really slutty and sexy gay man who is from Belgium. And so I would show up. The crew was all women. And my pattern instructor, Yuta, would hand me a pattern, hand me muslin, which is like a cheap fabric that you make drafts with, kind of like scratch paper. And say, make this, sew it up, let's see what it looks like. So I would be in this small atelier, which is like a workroom with other interns my age. And we would just spread it out, you know, pin everything very delicately, cut it up, sew it up. They just handed us all the materials. And because I was super experienced, it wasn't hard, but it was very intimidating. So I, that summer, learned to sew very, very well because I didn't want to disappoint them.
Yeah. Trial by fire.
Yeah, it's a huge responsibility to do that. I remember one time they had me draft a pattern and bring it to them to make, and I gave it to them. And as they're fitting something, I realized, oh my God, this was off grain. Like, this was not straight. And I was like, give me 1 second, and like ran into the atelier, redrafted it, recut it out, brought it out to them, and was like, throw this away. I'm sorry. It's wrong. And they were like, okay. You know, and they weren't mad, but you could tell, you could like sense the tension.
Yeah.
But I love that because that summer was tough. And I also got to assist them in their menswear fashion show, which was so great. Bernard Wilhelm kind of did a different take on the typical fashion show runway and created these kind of living tableaus, living moments throughout a building. And it was interesting because a lot of the work reminded me of my own work. And he had these huge backpacks that were glittery and sparkling, kind of camping style. And I had done something like that for my junior presentation the year before. It was a collection about like queer mobility and creating your own home and destabilization of like your home life and your home base. So anyways, I was like, wow, this is so me. Like, I love this. And I brought it up to him. I was like, you know, this really reminds me of the work that I make. Have you seen it? And he said, oh yeah, I saw it. You know, and I realized that he was a part of bringing me on their crew and maybe was inspired by my work.
Cool.
Yeah. That's really incredible.
It was incredible.
Wow.
I feel super lucky to have done that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What did your time in Paris at all inform? Because I know that Europe has a lot more kind of like fluidity in terms of like gender identity and stuff like that. Did your time in Paris at all influence your work in producing your Nat gear?
When I got there, I linked up with a bunch of queer Parisians. I have a larger
That sounds like a party.
Yeah. I have a large following on the internet, and at the time I was using Tumblr a lot.
Tumblr's great.
Tumblr's amazing, and it connected me to a lot of awesome queers. So we started going out, we started partying, and you know, Paris wasn't as diverse as I wanted it to be. A lot of my Parisian friends were amazing, but there were not a lot of people of color. There were not a lot of diverse bodies at all. A lot of the folks I was partying with were sexy, kind of androgynous white folks.
Mm-hmm.
And that inspired me. They didn't inspire me, but I was inspired by my desire to create more past that.
That's super interesting. And that's something that I'm interested in performing, because and I'm sorry that I keep kind of bringing it back to opera, but it's what I
love comparisons. It's amazing.
Well, and it's very relevant when you get into these kind of European mindsets of art.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because in opera right now, there's a lot of discussion of different bodies. And it used to be that, you know, the ingenue, the romantic lead could be a larger person, a person who takes up more space. Mm-hmm. But
that was disparaging, because like look at Maria Callas, right? Where like everyone was like, well, she lost all of that weight.
Yeah.
And it was like she was like under a microscope for it.
Absolutely. No. And I mean, the culture around bodies in opera used to be different.
Yeah.
And it's getting to the point where if you are not, especially in Europe, actually, where if you're not this, like, you know, willowy, you know, waifish thing, able to do backflips and with experience in like aerial work, like you're not going to get work as a singer, which is ridiculous.
Well, because there's a push to try and make opera more like theater, that where it's like they want to be able to take things and put it up for the big screen. They want to video record things and put it up for Met broadcasts and stuff like that. And so there's a lot more emphasis, which there's nothing wrong in concept about pushing towards being more visual, right? But there is something wrong with pushing towards being more visual and being shitty about it, like being like
weird and specific about the visual you want in terms of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I identify a lot with, because it's something as a plus size woman and as a plus size performer that I have run into before. You know, I've been double cast in something where, you know, there'll be two people cast as the same role, and my slender counterpart will get more performances than I will, even though we sing it equally well. And so the idea of, you know, kind of, you know, that lack of diversity lighting a fire under you.
Yeah.
Something I relate to a lot.
Yeah. You know, when I was in Paris, I just really longed for my queer nightlife community. And since I turned 21, or even before, when I had my sister's fake ID, I was going out in Chicago, and I just kind of considered myself like a queer socialite. And so being away from my queer community just made me ache for it even more. And when I came back, I had all of that confidence from my internship and all of this fire and intention to create amazing spaces and amazing work for Chicago. That I got inspired and started making more accessible pieces, more accessible spaces.
Cool. So my next question actually is kind of tying this into something. I'm curious, when we're talking about diverse bodies, is that something that you find a lot or a little in fetish wear?
I think that talking to, say, my mom about body positivity, sometimes people think of stuff they've seen in the media about fetishizing fat bodies. And that's not what I'm talking about at all.
Yeah.
Right. At all. I'm talking about celebrating, glorifying, worshiping diverse bodies because they are sexy. And I think that greater culture sometimes teaches us like that they are not, but that's wrong. And I create work for all bodies, all gender identities, all desire spectrums. I think in Chicago, there's a huge movement towards making work that celebrates all bodies, and not just for the sake of being, you know, quote, body positive, but to genuinely uplift everyone in our community because they're really hot.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I wonder, there was a they're like catch-all words that kind of larger organizations tend to use mm-hmm. that, you know, in their roots, it's like, oh, that's really great conceptually, but you can tell they just like slap it on a thing and it's like, oh, well, now we're progressive. Like, yeah. We talk a lot about accessibility. Like, a lot of opera companies will be like, we're accessible. And it's like, well, what does that actually mean? Like, what are you actually doing? And I almost wonder if like body positivity has like a fear of heading in that direction.
Oh, of like saying that we're body, like of it being like a company isn't worth their salt unless they say that they're body positive.
Well, yeah. And I also think maybe of kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Coming away from what the movement's original intentions were. Kind of like, I almost wonder, and obviously I'm going to preface as I always do that I'm the straight white guy talking, but like, that if there's a tendency to kind of like hypersexualize body positivity mm. and it ends up not being so much about, and not that there's anything wrong with the pro-sex movement, but it stops becoming about celebrating diverse bodies and more just about like hypersexualizing, like, curvy in the stereotypical way bodies, if that makes sense.
That's very real. You know, before I was coming here, I was thinking about my inspirations. Like, if y'all would ask me, you know, what inspires you? And
hey, Nat, what inspires you?
Yeah.
I was thinking a lot about, you know, genuinely, like, what gets me really excited. And something, you know, my list was like hot fat girls on Instagram. You know,
dude, me too. Yep. Hot fat girls on Instagram, make my day.
They do. I think they empower all of us and they're amazing, you know. And my hot, you know, femme queer friends here in Chicago, I was thinking about, you know, my ancestors, Latinas. There's a huge movement of Latinas here in the States, Mexican American queers making spaces for ourselves and creating work that references our collective understandings. I was thinking about my friends in nightlife. I was thinking about feminine Chicano boys. And I think that when you think about all of these, you know, marginalized groups, you can see their struggle and their trauma. And that is so important, and we need to hold space for that. But also, I think that we should be a part of our cultures in ways that celebrate them and not try and hide the parts of us that, like, white America has told us aren't worth anything.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I think that I look back to, you know, the Bruja feminism in my upbringing and with my family and with all of the people I know to kind of uplift us all and pull inspiration from our histories and from our ancestors.
So speaking of feminism and like strong female figures mm-hmm. in the Latina community, one of my first impressions of you in our orientation at work was that you left halfway through orientation to go to like a Selena like experience in Texas. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it sounded really fucking fun.
Sure. You know, Selena is very important to me as a Latina, as a Tejana, as an artist, as a femme, and as a woman. I'm from Texas. I'm Mexican American. And so the term for that is Tejana. It's a very nuanced Mexicana identity.
Cool.
And yeah, so I went back to Texas to link up with my tia for a second and then link up with my older sister. And we drove from Austin to Corpus Christi, where Selena is from, and went to Fiesta de la Flor, which is a huge Tejano music festival honoring Selena. It's put on by her family. And it was amazing.
Nice.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
For some reason, and this is nothing, and I'm so sorry to like bring this back to opera again, but I was just hearing a story today at work about how Verdi's family are like going through a huge legal battle for all of his works and stuff. And apparently the Italian government like is the state, the archival of the state is like going in and like taking the works from the family, which I think is really interesting because they want the family isn't giving, you're looking at this, me, this face, like, why is this even relevant?
No.
I just think it's really interesting because like they're, they want the works, Verdi's works to be open source, basically. They want anybody to be able to get to them.
Wait, the family or Italy?
Italy. And so, and the Verdi's family doesn't want that. And I don't know why, but so I just love the idea of flipping that on its head where it's like someone's family. Like, because of course, the Verdi's family is like, they all want money is the thing. So they want to be able to like, and so it's really like, I don't know, it's just, that's cool.
Did you get to meet any of Selena's family?
I did. Well, not personally necessarily, but I was in a very intimate talk with her sister, Suzette. And so I feel like I know her because wow. It was a very intimate panel with her and a couple of other Latinas. Her parents were just a couple rows away from me.
Oh my God.
And it was just like, oh, it was so much. I was like crying through the whole thing, just feeling so close to them and feeling her spirit through all of us was very powerful. And to be there with my older sister was beautiful. And I think that, you know, being in Texas at the beach, like where I'm from, felt so amazing. And I think that I brought a lot of that energy home. I host a queer Latinx dance party here in Chicago called Duro. I do that with DJ XP and Las Chanels, who are a trio of Latinx drag queens.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Can you talk a little more about that? Like, you mentioned that at work to me recently that you do is that the femme play party that you do?
Oh, no, that's something different. I'll get back to that. Okay. But I do a lot of parties. Yeah. I'm a busy girl. Duro is super amazing. It's a collaborative project between me and XP, who is my favorite DJ here in Chicago. He's a queer Latinx DJ here. So we create an installation every month in Berlin Nightclub. And we have performances that celebrate people of color. It's a consensual like dance floor. And we have treats. We have dulces, conchas, you know. And then we also have something that I started called Bebidas with Bay, which is a cocktail hour before Duro. Because Duro starts really late. It starts at like 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. But most folks can't come out that late. So Bebidas with Bay is from 10 to 12. I create a cocktail menu and the bar just lets me bring in supplies for them to make these really cute cocktails. It's more of a femme and queer woman centric cocktail hour because there aren't enough queer women and lesbian spaces in Chicago. And as a queer woman and a dyke, I want to make that space. So yeah, it's a really beautiful party. It's free. Sometimes cool. We have prizes to win. It's really great.
Cool.
That sounds so fun.
Yeah, and I host an MC. So I'm always wearing some little outfit and just up on stage with a microphone being really cute. We also have a social justice focus. So we partner with different organizations here in the city. Right now we're working with Generation L, which is a queer young adult and teenage, sex positive Latinx organization that does free testing, empowers people with resources for their sexual health, and keeps everybody happy, pleasured, and safe.
That's so important, I feel.
It really is.
The idea of, because I don't know, I growing up in the Midwest, in, you know, a more, you know, religious, you know, minded community where there was a lot of shame put on that. Like there was a lot of shame associated with sex and with pleasure and stuff like that. And I think that that's a really fantastic, you know, that's a really awesome thing to do for young people is destigmatizing it because literally everybody does it unless you're like clergy, like unless you're like, you know,
or asexual
yeah,
precisely,
right.
So I think it is such a huge part of our existence,
yeah, truly.
And it's you know, to destigmatize it, I think is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So it was called Generation L.
Yeah, Generation L pops up at our parties.
Cool.
And I want to take that a little farther, what you brought up earlier, destigmatizing sexuality and encouraging pleasure. I have worked a couple of years now with a bunch of folks here in Chicago creating queer, gender non-conforming, and femme-centric play parties.
Mm-hmm.
If y'all aren't familiar with what a play party is, it's a party where folks get together and play in a BDSM sense, or maybe not in a BDSM sense, but in a sexual sense. So it can range from, you know, erotic touching to spanking, BDSM kind of impact play to sex. And I've worked with Queer Color Kinksters, which is an amazing POC play party here in Chicago. And recently, me and my best friend, Tesh, hosted a play party at her house. It was Femme for Femme.
Cool.
Yeah. And it was really amazing because the play party was Femme for Femme. You know, we didn't want to have masculine folks there because I think often, especially with, like, queer women, when there's a masculine person there or a butch, like, a lot of the sexual energy focuses on them. So we wanted to eliminate that aspect so that the queer femmes and queer women at the party could focus on each other. I think that as women, no matter what sexuality you are, our sexuality is stifled. We're told that what we want isn't that important, and we're not encouraged to follow our own desires, but rather provide pleasure to others.
Yeah, I was going to say that's actually a really interesting and beautiful and fun analytical game to play.
Yeah.
Of being like, oh, that's such a powerful statement on society that like that. And I just think that's really cool because like that is so if you try and extract just like what that says about like men in the world, I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really great. And in those spaces and in all of my parties, I do promote like a femme for femme celebration, but that also definitely includes non-binary folks and transmasculine folks. I think that to exclude transmasculine folks in femme spaces, it can be very harmful. I think that some masculinity straddles the line in the gender binary. And I think that we need to include all people. Trans women are definitely always welcomed and celebrated because it's a woman celebrating space.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I've had a lot of conversations online with people about non-binary people and transmasculine people not being allowed in our spaces. And I personally don't believe in that. I believe that femme is any gender, it's any body. It's not one presentation, and it's not one way of being.
Mm.
That's such an important conversation to be having, you know, especially now with all of these like trans protective things being taken away. The idea of really protecting, you know, populations and groups of people who kind of don't have a place to go, you know, who don't.
Truly,
yeah. And so just the idea of an openness of the femme identity, like femme does not mean that you were born with a vagina or necessarily. It just means that you are femme.
Yes.
And I think that that's, so kudos for being so outspoken, because it's because you need to be.
Yeah.
And is that really, when it comes down to like what's the difference between trans women and trans femme, is that it's because and obviously, again, I'm like wading into territory here, like if this is totally incorrect, just like tell me I'm stupid.
Yeah.
Like but because I almost feel like when you say trans men or trans man or trans woman, it implies the like binary, because it implies that that is like post surgery maybe or something like that. Or is that
not totally necessarily?
Yeah.
Trans now is like such an expansive identity that some people do transition to become the other end of the binary. You know, there's the narrative of being stuck in the wrong body.
Right.
But that is only one of 1,000 trans identities.
Right.
So what I'm talking about is folks all over that spectrum. And no matter where your body's at in your transition, it's still valid and beautiful and important. And no matter where your body's at in that transition, you can identify as femme or masculine or non-binary or somewhere in between.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'm saying that all folks are welcome in the sense that we're not going to police anyone's gender.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah.
And for these parties, do you kind of pop them up whenever you want? Or like if someone wanted to say, reach out to you and say like, hey, I want to have a play party. Like, can I hire you? Or is that something you do?
Yes. That's definitely what I do. I've begun delving more into like event planning and event management, which I would love to do more of. But in my past, it's mostly party promoters and clubs hiring me on to create the space, create the atmosphere, help them figure out the decor and the branding. So yeah, folks usually hire me on to help with that.
That's fantastic.
Cool. Well, we have a few minutes left. So one of the last things we do with our guests is we give them a minute to plug any upcoming events or anything they're working on. Sometimes that's obvious, like if someone has an immediate event coming up, they want to talk about that.
Awesome.
Otherwise, it can be like a TV show you really like, just anything you want to shout
out or like someone doing super, someone in the city doing super rad art, or like if, say if you create fetish wear, like where one could find it.
Yeah.
For example.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you're looking for my work to buy in a shop today in Chicago, you can go to Early to Bed. Just down the street from where we're at now, which is an amazing queer-owned and operated sex shop here in Chicago. You can also get my stuff in Wicker Park at Coco Rococo. It is an 80s and 90s vintage shop that sells artists and designers' work as well. There I sell more like chokers and more fashion pieces, some bags. You can order online. I have a web shop now. My website is natmadrid.com. And upcoming events, I am hosting Femmes Room here in Chicago at Berlin. I am hosting Chisme, which is the fundraiser for Duro. Because we don't make a ton of money off the party, we host these amazing house party fundraisers. This one we're doing is a brunch, a Tex-Mex brunch from like 12 to 5.
Cool.
We're taking a break. It's the day after Cinco de Mayo. So we're hosting a brunch for us to recover and then taking a break at 10 p.m. XP is going to be DJing and we're going to host an amazing party. So that's going to be great. Then Duro, check that out. I also frequently go-go dance and host at Deep Dish, which is a party by Lucy Stuhl, who's an amazing Chicago body positive queen. What else? Tonight, I'm going to this party called Peach Party. That is a queer women's focused party that I'm very excited for. I even painted my nails peach for it. Pretty cute. Yeah.
Cool.
And you can find us both at Fairgrounds.
You can.
In Bucktown.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazing at latte art. It's my claim to fame.
I'm not so amazing at latte art, but I'm an excellent conversationalist and can tell you a lot about the coffees that I make on pour over.
Mm. Yeah, cool.
True. You're really great at that.
Great. Right. Well, I'm actually going to plug something real quick. We had them on the show last week, but I'm in a show right now of Bohème. There is a half off ticket. Originally, I felt like it was a little overpriced. It was $50 a ticket. But if you enter the code SPECIALGUEST, all caps, on the site, you can get in for only $25, which means you're literally only paying for the food.
Nice.
Perfect.
Yeah, so that is that's in Pilsen at Nightcap Coffee Bar.
Tonight. Meal.
So Friday night, Friday the, what is the day, the 21st?
Yeah.
Friday the 21st, Saturday the 22nd, and then Sunday The 23rd.
You get a 3-course meal and you get to see La Boheme mm-hmm. in a coffee place in Pilsen.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get to see me sing an aria to a coat. It's great.
Yep.
Yeah. I have a love affair with a coat in this aria. It's great. Cool. Okay. That's my shameless plug. So if you like what more plugging time, if you like what you've heard, there are tons of ways that you can keep in touch with us. You can head over to scopymag.com. Keep an eye on that because we've got a few story pitches coming in, and so we're gonna have new articles up soon. If you want to keep posted on social media of things that we upload, things that we post, and see lunches that we go out to, because that's what we did the last couple days when we didn't have episodes, you can check us out on Facebook under Scopy Magazine. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Scopy Mag.
And as always, I'm here to emphasize the importance of donations. We run on a shoestring budget. We're really working hard on getting some outside performances going. We want to, you know, reach out to the community. We did a promotion recently where if you donated or if you became a monthly donor within the 2 days before my birthday, we donated your first month to Planned Parenthood. We're going to probably look into doing more of those things just because it worked. And then we got to make a donation to a cause we cared about. So it was awesome. But, in the meantime, know that your donation makes a huge difference in our lives. It makes doing this so much easier. Head to scopymag.com. You can go to our about section, hit that donate button. If you become a monthly subscriber, we'll give you a shout out on the show. And we are working on some other incentive-y type things. Mm-hmm. And if you do a one-time donation, then we will write you a handwritten thank you note in the mail. Because we cute. Mm-hmm. Give a little. Give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Yep. Go out and make something.